Katie 2 CTJ from Echolink audio check.
Your audio is very nice. 5x5 over here in Queens County.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Just testing out some new gear here and new microphone and audio interface for my computer, so I just want to make sure I'm getting out there. I appreciate it. Katie 2 CTJ. Clear and listening.
Papa Zulu testing 1 2 3 4 5. Anybody ready around for a radio test?
Radio's 5x5.
Radio sounds good, Hal. AC2WGB.
Oh, okay. Thanks, John. Just said I just wanted to check here. I got a radio off level up a little bit. I see it's a little bit down. Hold on one sec, John. I'm going to increase the radio level up a bit.
Hal, your signal is kind of weak. So I don't know if it's a power problem or if you're just using a crummy antenna, but the signal's quite weak going into the repeater.
Crummy antenna. That's what the whole thing is, not power. Hold on one second. Let me just check. Hello. 1 2 3 4 5 5 4 3 2 1. 1 2 3 4 5. K6CTC testing.
How that time the audio seemed a little brighter.
Alright, the mic is no bargain on this, so that's maybe why we're having a problem.
And you're working, that sounds like an HT on a little bench whip or something like that, is that correct?
No, it's not an external antenna. The antenna is in a very bad spot. It's very well shielded to the repeater.
Oh, okay. Alright, but you do have good RF and good audio, just that the power's a little low.
Yeah, I can see that mic leaves a lot to be desired.
Yeah, if you're watching your signal coming back from the repeater, you can tell exactly what's going on.
Yeah, I'm monitoring it both ways, John. Yeah, it's just a little soft. Okay, very good, John. Thanks very much. I'm going to get done with this thing.
Okay, Hal, enjoy the evening. KC2WGB, clear.
K6 Delta Papa Zulu is clear. We should sound a little better now, John.
The RF sounds a little better. Can't tell. I'm not looking at the instrumentation. But it's, for some reason, a little more bass this time in the audio.
Alright, yeah, it has a little better response. There were two audio level sets on this. One is the HF, one is for VHF. I just brought up the VHF audio level, so it's a little bit better.
Oh, I think when you get that up to a regular antenna and get your power set up, you're going to be fine with that. Sounds good. All right. Talk to you down the log. KC2WGB clear.
K6TCZ clear.
Time is 7:30 p.m. Welcome to the W2VL repeater. Good evening.
KC2ALC, you're barely making the repeater.
How's that? A little bit better?
A little better. Less white noise.
Thank you.
climbing on top of each other when it comes to the space that should be left between conversations, and therefore that portion of the system times out, and they're left in the dark for a while, and that's not fair to them. So we're going to make an attempt to periodically leave a long enough time to make sure everything gets reset. You're hearing lots of reports about the total amount of damage that Hurricane Sandy, or Superstorm Sandy, which wasn't even a hurricane when it hit us, but my goodness, did it do damage. Right now it is rated as the second most expensive devastating event that happened in the United States throughout its history. The biggest event was $108 billion worth of damage, which was Hurricane Katrina. Sandy is right now running something in the vicinity of $80 billion worth of damage. That's just counting dollars, not counting lives lost and the misery of lots and lots of people no longer having a home. So, ham radio supplied. Let me drop.
A quick update for you, Dick.
I'll go over to you on that one, John. Ham radio supplied a lot of what we think was vital communication to people during that time. Where was the storm hitting? Who was without power? Who was being flooded? Where the gas lines were the least? Lots and lots of people were passing information days later, week later, as to where you could still get gas for your automobile or gas for your generator. Lots of people had generators, but didn't have enough gasoline to run them to create creature comforts in the house. What's the right size generator? How do you make a generator compatible with your uninterruptible power network, which is another whole subject? How do you make sure that the batteries work correctly? How do you charge your cell phone? The reliability of cell phones. We've all discovered that the cell phones don't have anywhere near the reliability we thought they had when you have a situation like this. Ham radio is what really came through. Go ahead with your information, John. KC2WGB, K2RAW.
Dick, just wanted to give you an update. Eric has made some adjustments to the system. You should notice a big improvement this weekend. The exchanges should go a little better.
Yeah, I know that one of his remote inputs, which I think was from the Plainville site, that particular PL tone wasn't being properly read and wasn't coming through. So when it comes to more of his remote inputs being functional, I think that's a factor that became improved. And maybe you're also addressing something with reference to the timing and whether or not we have to wait another 1 or 2 seconds beyond the 4 beeps. So I wonder which you meant, John. KC2WGB, K2RAW.
Yes, Dick, the PL tone and the votive system, he made a few program changes, so that should go better. And we do have to pay attention to that delay, like I just did a few seconds. That's helping out a lot of people, and all of the stuff seems to be locking up in sync. So what you did last week was perfect. Got good reports. I got some nice emails on it.
And if I know, you probably also got a number of emails from people that are in the process of getting their license, the so-called mailbag, John's mailbag, which used to be called Mel's mailbag. Okay. A person signs into the technical map by giving John and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes. A typical sign-in might sound like this: Kilo 2, Mike, uniform, Bernie, and yes. I think Bernie's possibly going to sign in tonight. Okay, give me your call letters and name right now, K2RAW.
U2OSR?
Yes.
W2YY?
Go.
Yes.
2XJN? Yes.
Why?
Yes.
Yes, for comment.
Okay, so far we've got Bob, Joe, and Wes, and then after that there was some doubles. Who signed in after Bob, Joe, and Wes? Go ahead.
D2BHY, yes.
We got you, Jim. Who else signed in besides Bob, Joe, Wes, and Jim? Give me your call letters and name right now.
Yeah, you see that, Scott in Toronto. Yes, for comment.
Okay, we heard ZTZ in Toronto. And, my goodness, that's not Jim. That is,
Scott.
Scott, yes, good enough. Okay, Scott, we got you. Alrighty, let me make sure I got you on the list. Who is the other person signing in?
Yes.
Unfortunately, that was a very heavily...
N2LDY.
Okay, N2LDY. We got you on the list. But you were only there a little bit less than 50% of the time, so anything you can do to a little more power or aim the signal in the right direction. The voting system right now is not favoring you, Mr. LDY. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name right now. Okay, and somebody listening, but we didn't hear your call letters, sir. Bob, W2OSR, you're number one on the runway. You got it, Bob.
Hey, okay, Dick, W2OSR. This should be a quick, easy question, if you know the answer to it. I just had to upgrade my computer because of a computer crash, so I've got a new computer, and my old copy of EasyNet will not work with it, so I look to see how much the new one is, and I can afford it. So what I'm trying to find out, what's the difference between EasyNet version 5.0 and 5.0 Plus? There is a price difference, so I'm assuming there's more features in one than the other, but couldn't find it on their website.
Yeah, I wish I knew that. And if my son, KB2IQN, was available, he might be able to give us an answer. He goes heavy into the computer programs. I'm very light on that subject. So I hope somebody within the tri-state area is familiar with EasyNet 5.0 and 5.0 Plus and can tell us why one is more expensive, what are you getting for your money, because Bob is trying to make sure he takes his hard-earned dollars and puts them in the right place. So anybody with EasyNet 5.0, 5.0 Plus information, please give us your call letters right now. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Recommendation, Dick.
Go right ahead, John.
There might be a users group on YouTube. There usually is. Bob, you might want to try that. It's the only thing I know of.
So, John, well, I'm going to say 7-3 for the moment, guys. I will be listening a little bit later. I've got to do a little grocery shopping here. Take care. Catch you all later, W2OSR.
Yeah, I do hope, Bob, that when you Google the word 5.0, 5.0 Plus, and EasyNet on Google, and or by way of YouTube videos, you use those as search words. I hope you're going to find something. Please, when you do find something, come on back and tell us what you find. You're doing the research for us. Looks like he and his lady friend get the free dinner tonight. They stumped the staff of experts in the tri-state area that were present at this time, John. Okay. The next person on the list was Joe, W2RYY. How are things going in your neighborhood, Joe? You were one of the lucky ones that I think was only out of power for a short period of time. I was on generator for 4 days. My neighbor right across the street was on out of power for 14 days. I was without internet for something like 12 days. We've all suffered. You didn't. You're one of the lucky ones, Joe. W2RYY. You're born under the right star. K2RYW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. Well, I didn't do too bad as far as electrical outage, but I had some other things happen. I sent you some pictures, by the way. Did they arrive at your computer location?
Okay, you're going to have to give me a hint. What day did you send the pictures? If you sent them in the last couple of hours, I probably didn't get them because I haven't looked at my email. I was doing some tower work. So what day did you send them? And give me a hint as to what picture it is. That way I'll remember whether or not I saw it. I'm awfully forgetful, Joe, as you're about to find out again. You got it, Joe.
I sent them sometime between November 3rd and now. Oh, really? I sent them about 3 weeks ago, actually. I don't remember the exact day. I don't know if my computer would actually tell you that, but that's not what my question is.
Yeah, give me a hint as to what the picture is. You tell me what it is, and I'm going to say, oh, yeah, I remember that. What was the picture of, Joe?
The result of a windstorm, what it does to a chimney.
There's the clue. Joe had a station master antenna, something with a
pretty long altitude to it. Some of those station masters are 15 and 18 feet tall, connected to a pretty sturdy looking chimney, but still that's a very large moment of inertia. In a high wind, that created a bending torque that took a significant portion of Joe's chimney, snapped off the brick and mortar interface, the chimney, the antenna, and everything was hanging on his roof by the coaxial cable. It would have all come tumbling to the ground, except for that coaxial cable holding it all together, which reminds me of the big damage I heard had at the top of my 100-foot tower, where my 2-inch diameter piece of mast snapped, and my my Yagi's and 1296, correction, 10 gigahertz dish was all hanging by the cable. And so the right solution for me would be just climb the tower and capture it and put it all back together. Of course, it was a super windy day, therefore I couldn't climb the tower. All of that hardware was swinging back and forth at the top of the tower in the wind. The elements on the end of the 432 Yagi kept stabbing into the hard line at the top of the tower. Angiohelyacs poked holes in the side of the angiohelyacs airline. Not only did the wind for a couple of solid days when I couldn't climb up there and fix it was doing all that damage, of course it was followed by rain, and lots of rain poured into those holes of the air-filled angiohelyacs. So one of those pieces of cable on my tower is the most useless thing in the world. Haven't got around to removing it yet. I know for a fact water poured into it because it's got a ridiculous amount of loss. And when the freezing occurred a little bit after that, the bottom of the cable where the water was bulged out. Angiohelyacs, 7/8 angiohelyacs with water inside, freezing, bulges out, looks funny, ugly. So one of my pieces of cable in the tower, really an ugly mess. So
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
So you and I came close to similar amounts of damage, Joe. And so you might give us a couple of words as to how difficult it was to get your chimney all back together. W2RYY with that information and then your question, if you like, K2RYW.
The chimney situation has not been resolved yet. It's pretty much exactly like it was. And the other thing I have to say to you is, aren't you glad you ran into a real good deal with Hardline?
Can you imagine that Joe has these reels of 100 and 200 feet, 7/8 inch Hardline sitting in his basement? For a solid year and a half, he's telling me to come over and get it. The price is very, very good. And because of a bunch of laziness and other priorities and whatever on my part, it took him something like a year and a half to talk to me over there to pick up this cable. Me and my son with two separate vehicles, I picked up these big reels of cable. Andrew 7/8 inch Heliax these days, I am guessing, sells for around $5 or $6 per foot. And he had to twist my arm to get him there, to get me there. Something's wrong with that picture, isn't it, Joe? The H-R-I-Y, K-2-R-I-W.
With brass connectors.
Yeah, the connectors on each end, type N connectors on Andrew 7/8 Heliax, I'm guessing they go for $10 or $12 or $15 a piece. So each piece of cable had connectors on the end. I believe the cable had even been swept in frequency and TDR tested. In other words, each piece of cable was essentially traceable to the bureau. Is that almost true, Joe? Go ahead.
Yeah, but we go on and on about this. Those connectors are probably about $50 a connector, actually, in reality. The last time I priced this stuff, they're not cheap if you buy brand new connectors. But anyway, let's move on with the question. Because it's a question, two questions dealing with the same kind of subject.
I'll fire away with the question, but wait for the for the multiple beeps.
Okay, the question has to do with amplifying an AM signal using an amplifier that you don't know how to set this thing as far as some of the parameters inside. One key parameter happens to be the bias that they're using on the devices to do with the amplification. It's a FET type of device. I can tell you the number, but I don't remember the specific parameters of the device itself. It's called an SR341. It's good for, you know, several amps of current, and several watts, many watts out per device. I can tell you that the safe operating current, it can run between, say, 0 and about 8 amps. My first question is, being that you can adjust the bias voltage and by adjusting the bias voltage, look at the static current that the device draws without the amplifying RF signal. Would you say a safe place to set that is somewhere between the maximum current or near maximum current and minimum current for a bias adjustment? That's the first question.
Yeah, good sounding question, Joe, but there's a couple of more parameters involved. If those field effect transistors are being used in a Class B push-pull circuit, and they only need a small amount of forward bias just to make sure they're in the active region, then on each half cycle, on the positive half cycle, the right-hand FET goes into conduction. On the negative half cycle, the left-hand FET goes into conduction. That's Class B push-pull, AB1 push-pull. If each individual device is being run in a single-ended Class A mode, and you want maximum power output and maximum linearity, then yes, the bias current is going to be somewhere between zero and the maximum. If they can go from 0 to 8 amps, something in the vicinity of 4 amperes of forward bias would have then allowed the signal to go on, giving you be applied to the device, and during the positive half of the signal, the 4 amps jumps up to 8. During the negative half, the 4 amps jumps down to 0, and now you're sitting right in the middle of the maximum swing dynamic range of your plot, so to speak, of current versus voltage on that set. Let me drop.
Let me tell you the class that they're being used in.
Yeah. So I'm going to tell you both answers, even though you only have one of them. So setting up Class A is very different than setting up push-pull Class B. So the way the topography of the transistors is being used is a big variable in this case. And in any case, if it's a real good data sheet written by the manufacturer, he shows you a typical circuit. He tells you the amount of bias, voltage, and current. He shows you what impedance input, what impedance output. In theory, a real good manufacturer gives you that all information. And 98% of the time, what they tell you is pretty darn close to accurate. You do it, and good results happen. But let's face it, there's a hell of a lot of situations where you haven't got all that information, in which case you're left to do a laboratory experiment. And the gold standard for linearity and power output is a so-called two-tone test, the way guys test the linearity of the single sideband transmitter. With great care, combining two entirely different signal generators, whether it be the audio going into a sideband microphone circuit, or whether it be a pair of RF carriers going into an RF amplifier circuit, you, with great care, make sure that the two separate signal generators are being combined in a way that gives you thorough isolation, 80, 100, 120 dB of isolation. If you can get it between the two signal generators, make the two signals exactly equal to each other in amplitude, just the right separation, put them into the amplifier, put them into a very high dynamic range spectrum analyzer looking at the output, and therefore start tuning for peak envelope power, acceptable amount of third and fifth order intermodulation distortion products. There's a whole series of tests to be done to confirm the linearity of your particular serial number in that particular location.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Over to you, Joe, and give us the additional info. You got it, Joe.
Okay, the circuit is being used in a Class A type of amplifier, which has approximately, I guess, 25% efficiency. So, from what you're saying, I guess I'm not too far off in setting it correctly. And you don't actually see the DC current change very much, with the thing amplifying about up to about 44 watts out with 0 dBm in, because it has theoretically the whole amplifier unit has a gain of about 50 dB. So you don't see the current increase more than about an amp or two, actually, on the current pole. The second question related to this amplifying system is, you said a couple weeks ago, I asked you something about amplifying an AM carrier, and the result you'd see on amplifying an AM carrier with between 0 modulation and 100% modulation was approximately 1.76 times what the carrier will be. Now, I noticed that I do get this if I measure the output of the signal generator that's driving this particular amplifier with no amplification, and say the generator is putting out 0 dBm, it goes up about 1.7 decibels
when you apply 100% modulation, okay? But when you look at the output of the amplifier, the output of the amplifier goes much, much higher than that. In other words, if you increase, say, the input by 3 dB, the power will go up to 200 watts, 100 watts to 200 watts. You increase another dB, it goes up to, say, about 250. All right, but keeping the input, say, at 0 dB, which is where it's supposed to be, if you add 50% modulation from the generator, your resultant power that you see measured on a Bird wattmeter, and I forget the exact particular wattmeter, I'm not sure if it reads peak or it's reading average, I think it's an average reading wattmeter, goes up about 100 to 170 watts. If you go to 100% modulation, the result you see in the Bird wattmeter goes past 300 watts. And I only did that very briefly because I don't want to damage the amplifying system, so back to you. I'm just trying to understand if there's something I'm doing wrong, if something's being done wrong, either with measurements or whatever, because I see a power meter measuring the generator and showing a certain increase in decibels as far as the input drive level between no modulation to full modulation. And the result of the output of the amplifier shows me something a little different, like almost like a ratio of like 2 to 1.
Yeah, complicating your situation, Joe, could easily be that your power indicating device might be somewhere in between averaging and peak reading. Let me show you the way the old-fashioned amplitude modulation used to be. Back in the days when John and I went before the FCC examiner in New York City, and we took our general class license, and we used to have to draw diagrams in the very beginning, way back in the late 50s. And the diagrams you drew for an amplitude-modulated transmitter, you had a modulation transformer changing the voltage, the plate voltage on your final transmitting RF tube, and if it was a 100-watt transmitter, for instance, you needed 50 watts of audio. So a thoroughly separate circuit supplied 50 watts of audio for 100 watts of carrier transmitter, and the transformer, the modulating transformer, combined the two. Therefore, with no speaking into the microphone, 100 watts came out of the transmitter. You give a pure sine wave, 100% amplitude modulation. 50 watts of audio got combined with 100 watts of RF, and you did put out 150.0 watts. 100 watts versus 150 watts is a 1.761 dB increase, 1.76 dB. So if you had a pure averaging power meter, you would go up 1.76 dB when you hit 100% pure sine wave modulation with no distortion anywhere in the system. That's what the average power did. The peak power went up by 4 to 1. What that modulation transformer did is instantaneously at the peak of the RF of the audio voltage, it doubled the plate voltage on the tube, and if the tube is running Class A linear AM service, double voltage, double current, four times the power. There would be a 100-watt transmitter.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
A perfect broadcast standard 100-watt AM modulated transmitter. 100 watts would be the average when you're not speaking into it. 150 watts would be the average when you spoke into it with pure sine wave, 100% modulation. But if you're looking with an oscilloscope, the peak envelope power would be 400 watts. That's a 6 dB increase in peak if everything is perfectly linear. As you can tell, to really properly reproduce amplitude modulation on a amplifier where you're not using a plate modulation transformer, so-called high-level modulation, you're doing it by the power you're putting into the input stage of this amplifier, and you want the output to properly reproduce with linearity. It's got to have a headroom of 4 to 1 in power. If you're running that output at 100 watts and you want a carrier power, and you want to have the ability to, with perfect linearity, reproduce that one single AM modulated 100% signal, your headroom must be 400 watts peak envelope power output. You take one other situation I'm going to tell you about. Let me drop. And that is, you take any real solid-state transistorized amplifier you can put your hands on, a Mirage, a Tentec, a TPR, any of these, I said Tentec, I can't even think of the brand names of these darn things. I got one sitting here. I got to go around and turn. modulators, brick amplifiers, you know, afterburners that we buy. If you did a plot, a careful plot of power input versus power output, you'll see all kinds of crazy linearity, particularly at the high end, where you want to have the 400 watts of headroom on a 100-watt amplifier. As you start to driving it with a steady-state signal just to test for that, you'll find all kinds of compression takes place at the high end of almost every solid-state amplifier you can get a hold of. You take your normal brick amplifiers we add to a 2-meter, 6-meter, 432 amplifier, transmitter, and you put single sideband into it, and if you do a careful laboratory measurement, you'll be quite unhappy with the percentage of compression you're going to get. There are ways you can take the standard designs, rebias them, let me drop, and get, rebias them and get a little bit more linearity out of them. But as bought from the manufacturer, the biggest problems they've got is that there's very little shielding in the cabinet. You add one of those brick amplifiers to a repeater system, the leakage from the cabinet will drive your repeater crazy. Your duplexing filter will think it's got leakage up the kazoo. Sometimes a 150-watt output transistorized amplifier will have 5 watts pouring out of a 12-volt lead because it doesn't have enough filtering on that one, because it would be very expensive. The linearity on the high end is not good. And if you carefully plot power output versus power input, sometimes near the low end, it acts nonlinear in the other way, the opposite of compression. There's a name for that factor, I can't remember it now, the super biasing technique or something, a super biasing phenomenon. In other words, sometimes at the low end of the amplifier, where you're 10 or 15 dB down from the peak power, and you slowly increase the power by 1 dB, the output power goes up by 1.5. It was crazy. If you now plot that as a curve, you get a funny wiggle at the low end, you get a lot of compression at the high end. So the word linearity, the word intermodulation distortion control and whatever, for an amplitude modulated transmitter with modern day circuitry, not done with a high level modulating transformer and a separate audio circuit, let me drop. The bottom line of all this jazz is I'm giving you some of the individual details, Joe, but you are walking through a minefield. If you have to meet some very strict FCC requirements for something like an over-the-air broadcast transmitter or a cable television lighting system, and if there's some strict requirements that you've got to meet under these conditions, it ain't easy. I don't envy you. The good news is that as you acquire this knowledge, and when you're one of the few people in your organization that's got the knowledge, in theory, they should treat you with respect and assume that you walk on water. But to really make it all happen with the hardware in your hands is not easy. There's only 5 ways that it can all go wrong, if you know what I mean, Joe. I'm not trying to discourage you. I'm just trying to show you where the minefield is. What you're trying to do ain't easy. It's going to take a whole lot of individual tests and confirmation to prove that it's doing what you would like it to do. W-H-U-L-Y-Y, K-Q-L-I-W. Hope I'm not scaring you.
No, you're not scaring me at all. You see, one of the major problems is the particular product isn't supported by the manufacturer anymore in any means whatsoever. They just simply don't support it. The thing is like 8, 10 years old, and in its design, maybe something like that. But some of the equipment is actually newer than that, but they just simply don't support it. There's no engineering data that could be had to be able to tell you how to set the thing up for the bias. And that's why I took a guess as far as the thing being class A. If you set the bias somewhere between 0 to 100%, you can't be too far from being wrong. So I guess from what you said, when I told you with the parameters, set the thing at half current, maximum current, is probably being correct. But the other thing is just made me think that my instrumentation was actually reading wrong. But what I didn't do, and I may have a chance to do that, and I'll bring this information next time I check into the net, I'll have to read the power output with the actual same power meter that's reading the input. And I can't do that because I have a 30 or 40 dB pad that will handle at least 150 watts or so, and I'll be able to use the same power meter. See, if it reacts the same way, then the burned watt meter does. Actually, I'll be able to put two of them in series and see if I'm getting a differential in reading, because the power meter said the signal generator was acting correctly between no modulation and full modulation. Went up about 1.7 dB, but that's not what it's for the amplifier do. And I also did notice what you said about the linearity. With linearity changing, when I went to a much, much lower signal level, like sometimes 20 or 30 decibels lower, the gain I saw on the amplifier was different. It did not seem to track properly anymore.
On solid state amplifiers, Joe, I've seen that effect on a number of occasions, and it drives people crazy. Supermodulation, it's got a funny name. Bias rectification, supermodulation characteristics. There's a number of amplifiers, good designed amplifiers, that at the low end, if you plot power output versus power input, all of a sudden it has greater gain. In other words, you increase your 15 dB down from the peak power that the thing is capable of. You go up 1 dB, you expect the output to go up by 1 dB, and it goes up by 1.5 or 2 dB. And then at the top end of the dynamic range, you go up by 1 dB, and the power output goes up by 0.5 dB. So you plot this as a curve, and you get some really crazy curves. Not easy. Where you no longer have the manufacturer supporting the product. By the way, a bird watt meter. If you didn't buy the separate kit that makes your bird watt meter a peak indicating device, you'd like to believe it's an average indicating device. It is not. Let me drop it. If you're putting in two tones of RF energy, and if the two tones are, let me pick a number, a megacycle apart, 2 megacycles apart, which means the peaks and the valleys are occurring at every microsecond, every half microsecond, under those conditions, I believe the bird watt meter is pretty close to a averaging device. However, if the two signals you're putting in are closer than that, which means the peaks and valleys of, you know, interferometry of the two signals is happening slower, the diode rectifier in there on your little directional coupler where you set it in the forward mode or the reverse mode, the diode rectifier is a beautiful peak indicating device. The peak indicating device is going into the Dawson valve movement. The Dawson valve movement is a voltage averaging device. Well, if the diodes are acting in a square law, and you're taking a square law diode performance into an averaging multimeter characteristic, life gets complicated. Very similar to what happens if you take a vacuum tube voltmeter in the old days, and you try to use it to measure an AC signal, and you think you've got a pure voltage going into the meter, but the meter is averaging voltage, and you're trying to figure out how much power is being indicated. Life gets complicated. So the best I could recommend, Joe, is you keep coming up with various tests to confirm it's doing what you need, and one single test may not do it. And so it's going to take quite a bit of confirmation to make sure that you've got what you want. I'm not quite sure, Joe, is what you're building and confirming, is it a onesie, twosie, or are you trying to make a production run of 10 of these things? The B2LYY, K2LIW.
Well, let me just say this. First of all, I'm not doing a two-tone test at all. I don't have the facilities to be able to do that. I just can't come up with the kind of instrumentation you're talking about and the technique of how to do it. That's just not available to be able to do that. Sounds easy on paper, but it just doesn't happen that way in this particular situation. I'm doing these tests in the center of the band that it's made to operate, and I'm doing it with a single carrier, with either modulation applied or modulation not applied.
Okay, assuming, Joe, that you have access to a reasonably good quality spectrum analyzer, and assuming now that you can look with the spectrum analyzer on a directional coupler sampling port, power sampling port, as to what's coming out of your amplitude modulator signal generator. If it's a good Hewlett-Packard signal generator, which has an AM function to it, and most of those AM functions do a beautiful job at 50% modulation. I don't think a Hewlett-Packard guarantees the linearity when you ask for 100% modulation, but still, by looking with the spectrum analyzer at the carrier plus the two sidebands, if, for instance, you're modulating at, let me pick a number, a 10 kilohertz amplitude modulated sine wave rate, you should, out of the signal generator, see a separate carrier above the main carrier, 10 kilohertz higher and 10 kilohertz lower, and when that separate carrier is 6 dB weaker each, when the upper sideband and lower sideband are each 6 dB weaker than the center carrier, that is the condition of 100% modulation, and if the signal generator has real good linearity, there will be no other carriers there. But let me show you what's going to happen in the real world. Let me drop. Even on a high high-quality Hewlett-Packard signal generator that's rated for amplitude modulation. As you turn the modulation dial up to where it starts saying 100% modulation, yes, those two, the upper and lower carrier will be 6 dB down, but you'll start seeing seconds and thirds with a 10 kc modulation rate where you expect to be an upper sideband 10 kc up and another lower sideband 10 kc down, and each 6 dB down, you're going to see another sideband 20 kc up and 20 kc down. The second harmonic due to flat topping performance of the signal generator itself. But hopefully you can find a place in the signal generator, maybe where it's running 90% amplitude modulation, where the signal generator is reasonably clean on the spectrum analyzer. Then you switch the spectrum analyzer over to the output of your amplifier with some kind of a power sampling, directional coupler, pad, whatever. And again, into the same spectrum analyzer, look for the exact same characteristic coming out. And if what you see coming out is a hell of a lot stronger second harmonic, 20 kc up and 20 kc down in my example, that'll be a pretty good test of linearity. So by comparing input signal performance on the analyzer to output signal performance on the analyzer with one single carrier going in, that's the poor man's equivalent of a two-tone test, Joe. That's going to give you a lot of information. And then as you watch that signal coming out while you're adjusting the total signal power going in and you're adjusting biases at the same time, you're going to find a sweet spot with that test, in my opinion. Wonder if that makes some sense, Joe. W2LYY, K2LIW.
Okay, Dick. I've been doing the test with 1,000 hertz, but I will try doing it again with a 10 kilohertz audio signal applied to the modulator. And these are not like a production run. It's actually like trying to fix a few of them. And so far, I've got two done and a third to go. Well, the third will actually be ready tomorrow. It's ready to go. The others are, the others went for a swim, so they're not repairable.
Yeah, let me make something clear here, Joe. I used 10 kilohertz only as an example, and I led you to believe that there's something magic about 10 kilohertz. You're doing the test at 1 kilohertz, beautiful test. And as long as your particular spectrum analyzer has high enough resolution in its resolution bandwidth, IF video resolution bandwidth, to look at upper and lower sidebands 1 kilohertz away, you'd probably have to do it with a 100 hertz filter resolution bandwidth, which means you've got to sweep very slow and be carefully tuned to just the center and whatever. You're going to have drift problems and slowness of display problems. The nice thing about using 10 kilohertz is that now you can probably use a 1 kc res bandwidth filter to properly resolve those side lobes without them folding together, and now in the time domain things happen a lot faster. There's another thing going on here, Joe. Let me drop. In the real world of transistorized amplifiers, with real-world power supplies feeding them, it's obvious that during the amplitude modulation, you've got peaks and valleys of current being drawn by the amplifier. You've got peaks and valleys of heating going on within the final stage of the transistor. So when you make the modulation rate low enough, like 100 hertz of amplitude modulation, you're now getting into the time domain where the heating of the junction throughout the modulation cycle and the fade of the power supply on each half cycle of the modulation does some funny things. When you go to a higher modulation rate, you get more of an average heating of the device. You get more of a smoothing effect of the output filter capacitor of the power supply. So there's a lot of other funny things going on. You could easily run into the situation where with, let me pick a number, 10 kc of modulation, if your amplifier is broadband enough, or 50 kc of modulation, everything looks hunky-dory. You go down to 300 hertz of amplitude modulation, which is where the audio should go to have good high-fidelity audio. All of a sudden, the amplifier behaves very differently because of the ripple on the power supply running into pulses of current at that rate. As you can see, you've got more variables involved here, Joe, than you can shake a stick at. W2LYY, good luck with this project. It's a beauty. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. Thanks for the tip. I'll keep you informed as to the progress that's made here. W2LYY, back to net.
Very fine. All right, the next person on the list was Wes. And Wes did send us, if you go to K2YO's website, which I think was BernieFamily.com. I keep forgetting the website, but you guys know what it is. You'll find out that Wes has recommended that we look at a website which talks about line impedance stabilization network, which is sometimes called line impedance normalization network. What's going on here, let me drop. I'm going to give a little bit of an introduction of what I saw with that particular website, and then I'm going to turn it over to Wes to make sure that I'm not way off center of what he was asking. When you're doing electromagnetic interference testing of a system, the method by which your device under test can generate undesired signals is huge. And do the undesired signals come out the RF coaxial output connector? Possibly. Do they sometimes come out from the input RF connector by working backwards through that cable? Yeah. But the power cord, oh boy. The way you feed power into let me call it a black box. I got this box on the table where I've got a 110-volt line cord going into it. That gives it the raw power. And now it's supposed to do something. It's a transmitter, an amplifier, whatever. And you're doing electromagnetic interference test. One of the big ways by which your box can act as a transmitter of undesired signal is through the power cord. In the case of the brick amplifiers that we use for our mobile operations, you put an afterburner, like a Mirage Baker 1016, for instance, if you want 160 watts output on 2 meters, you install one of those in your car, and I have. Let me drop. It'll do a beautiful job under some conditions of taking the 10 watts output of your mobile 2-meter FM transmitter and boosting it up to a rated 160 watts. And mine, when it was fed from my particular car with 13.8 volts coming out of that alternator, mine would put out 180 watts with my directional watt meter I would put on the output side of it. And I had a lot of fun watching that watt meter sitting on the chair of the car as I'm driving along and seeing that when I transmit FM, 180 watts is coming out. That's the good news. With a little bit further testing, you'll find that out the 12-volt lead, a couple of watts of RF energy is coming out the 12-volt lead, being sprayed all over the car. And in some cases, some cars have got a sensitive instrument panel with a microprocessor feeding it, and it doesn't like all that RF running around. And in some cases, even the emission control computer can go crazy. Now, if you and I were running a test on that Mirage amplifier, and you want to find out how much signal is coming out, one huge variable would be, how do you wire it? If I take 15 feet of 8-gauge wire running from the battery going through the firewall of the car, and it goes into the amplifier, and those wires are or are not twisted, I can make a huge difference in the way the radiated RF power is radiated from that cable. Or if by chance I was smart enough to have some kind of a little bit of a black box where the 12-volt wires, the red and the black wire coming from the battery, going through the firewall, comes up to my little black box, and my black box is the world's best 12-volt, 20-ampere filter, inline filter, and now that is located a half an inch away from the Mirage amplifier. Under those conditions, even though the Mirage amplifier is trying to crank great big RF signals back into the 12-volt wiring, because of that great big filter I have put right there, and it's only an inch away, I could probably cut down the undesired radiation from the 12-volt wiring. Let me drop. With that fancy filter network I just added, I could cut down the radiation by probably 10 or 20 dB and maybe even more. As you can see, when you're now doing a so-called standardized test of an unknown circuit, the way you feed power into the circuit can make a huge difference in the measurement you make. So what the electromagnetic interference people have devised is a standardized test in which you have the so-called stabilization network, call it a filter network if you like, but the stabilization network has a known inductor, capacitor, resistor, coupling network. There's a known network by which you interconnect your raw source of power through that network into the device under test. And now that you've got a standardized way of terminating that device under test, you stand a chance of making a measurement in Laboratory A on Long Island, that when you go to Laboratory B in California, hopefully you'll get the exact same results. One of the huge problems that happens in the electromagnetic interference world is that by your particular testing procedure in your development laboratory. You do a test and think everything's hunky-dory, and then you ship the thing to the customer. They go over to the underwriter's laboratory and do a standardized test. They come up with very different results, and you might have some egg on your face. So this stabilization network that Wes is talking about is an attempt to try to level the playing field for that particular performance measurement. So the way you do the test can make a big difference in the results that you get and whether or not the results are traceable to the Bureau of Standards. That's part of what's going on here, Wes. NQXJN, go right ahead, KQLIW in the TechNet.
Thank you very much for touching the subject. And that was just the implementation or, say, introduction of line impedance stabilization network to the major and actually primary question that I have. And that would be, what is the impedance of power line? So, Dick, you're talking to me right now. Taxi driver, are you talking to me? And to action. And you're probably using 110 volts, 120 volts, up to 115 volts to power your rig. Would you please tell me what is the impedance of your power line? And to action.
Yeah, when it comes to impedance of a power line, you could have been asking me what is the impedance of my 110 volt power line, 120 volt power line that's feeding the rig you're listening to right now. Or the impedance of the 12-volt power line that would feed an amplifier if I was using an amplifier. In either case, it's you're going to get a different answer at different frequencies. If at the 60-cycle rate, if now I am only looking at 60-cycle characteristics of the 110-volt circuit, 120-volt circuit that's feeding this very transmitter, it's going back through, let me pick a number, 50 feet of wiring back to my circuit breaker panel, and that in turn goes through another 150 feet of wiring over to the full peak transformer. And if I did a careful measurement at 60 cycles, I might find that that circuit has approximately 1 ohm of impedance. I just chose that number where I drew a 10 amperes. If I had 1 ohm of impedance and I drew 10 amperes, I would see 10 volts of drop. That's Ohm's law. I probably have a tenth of an ohm. I drew a 10 amperes and the 120 volts goes down to 119. That's probably closer. My real wiring, if it's well done and I'm close to the circuit breaker panel, I might have a tenth of an ohm of 60-cycle impedance between me and Long Island Power Company, or in your case, between you and Consolidated Edison Power Company. That's at 60 cycles. But now your transmitter is running at 3.5 megacycles, we'll say, and now with laboratory instrumentation, let me drop. Now with that laboratory instrumentation, I do a good careful measurement at 3.5 megacycles. I'm going to see the tenth of an ohm of resistive component. I'll probably see the tenth of an ohm go up to a 20th of, to 2/10 of an ohm because of skin effect. So the resistive effect of the wiring is going to go up a little bit because of skin effect. The inductance of the wiring is going to be significant. I may find, I'm going to pick a number out of the air, 500 microhenries of inductance on that wiring that goes into the BX cable between my shack and the circuit breaker panel, and some number of other microhenries of that wiring that goes from the circuit breaker panel out to the pole peak transformer. So I guarantee that if you try to measure the impedance of your 120-volt circuit or of your 12-volt circuit, you're going to get a very different answer depending on what frequency you decide to make the impedance measurement at. As you go to higher and higher frequencies, the resistive component is going to go up because of skin effect. The inductive component is going to go up because of the length of the wire and the way the wire is dressed, the way it lays close to a piece of metal ductwork here and it goes around the corner over there.